I'm so hungry, I could eat a grown man's ass right now.
Welcome to BC and Maurice's Constant Content Crisis. In this episode, we have a long and broad collection of jawns for you. BC, what have you been up to recently?
Over the last 2 weeks, I watched a number of things, but some of the shows and movies that stood out, for better or for worse, were Masters of Air, The Bad Batch, Season 3, The Marvels, and Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. And I must say that the Marvels and Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, I was rooting for them, but they're quite disappointing. So RIP the DC movie universe. I look forward to seeing what James Gunn. I look forward to...
Not the killer from Silence of the Lambs.
No. Looking forward to what the director, James Gunn, has to offer with his reboot. And the Marvels, man, I don't know what to say. I guess you just watch it for the post credits, and hopefully we'll see a great reboot coming up with the new Deadpool movie.
Yeah, I'm definitely.
What have you been watching?
The last 2 weeks, eclectic as ever. I have too been watching The Bad Batch. I've watched the first three episodes with the boys. Not quite ready to go deep on that one yet, but I'm sure by the end of the series, I'll be happy to. I watched fully for the first time, I think, in my life, Pretty Woman randomly a couple of weeks ago. Big Trouble in Little China. I watched Contact with the boys at the weekend because my eldest son had his birthday and he loves kind of movies about space, but, you know, serious movies about space. So yeah, those were all enjoyable, but maybe for another conversation. I did read just before we jumped on, actually, that the new Superman movie is going to be shooting all over Ohio, which I have a faintly vested interest in. So apparently there's a tax break in Ohio now, so I think we should all just down tools, jump on the stagecoach and make for the Midwest. Sure, we can get a job as riggers or runners or I don't know.
Craft services?
You know, I'll take it. We've watched The Bear. We can do something with food.
Yeah, we just, you know, take over some buddy's restaurant and let's see what happens.
Exactly. Where can you go wrong? All right. Well, those are the ones that didn't make the cut, I guess. BC. What have you got for us, first of all, in this episode?
Well, I'm hoping that I'm pronouncing this accurately, but Shogun. I used to say Shogun until I was corrected by my wife and my brother-in-law the other night. Speaking about vested interests, my brother-in-law is an actor, and he knew one of the actors on the show, and my wife and brother-in-law grew up watching Samurai Fair in Japan, and they were blown away by the production of this show, and kind of also they laughed at the memories that they had of watching Japanese samurai shows on TV as kids, and just looking at just the lack of budget and just comparing it to what they were able to do with Shogun. So Shogun is based on a novel that was written in the 70s and the 1980s miniseries. Shogun 2024 is a more authentic take on the book that was written in 1975. It takes place during the Sengoku Jidai period, or the War in States period in Japan. And it follows the rise of this daimyo. So the daimyo in this show is based on Iyasu. However, for the novel and the miniseries, they've changed all the names, but all the main characters are based on historical figures. So Toranaga is based on Iyasu, and the Englishman, or the pilot, as they call him throughout the first episode, John Blackthorne, is based on William Adams and his exploits in Japan. And it's basically about Toranaga. He is in a precarious position because his former leader has recently passed away, and he is in charge of raising his son until his son is of age to take over Japan. In the meantime, he has a loose alliance with four other political leaders, and who are also jockeying for power. But his main rival is Ishiro. So when this English pilot washes ashore in Japan, it brings some political fortune to Toranaga, just with the weapons that were aboard his ship, as well as the dynamics that were going on between the English and the Portuguese. So since the Portuguese are Catholics, there's a huge rivalry between the English and the Portuguese, and the English basically reject everything that the Catholics are doing because they're Protestants and also want to stop the alliance that the Spanish and the Portuguese have, which is basically carving up the world. They already tackled parts of the New World, and now they're looking at parts of Asia, and Japan's in the mix. So he's basically, Blackthorne is basically throwing a wrench into the Portuguese plans in terms of how they want to take over the trade, as well as possibly conquer Asia through religion and through revolutions or inciting rebellion. So with this, Blackthorne is now a political pawn between the different factions in Japan, as well as he's an international player now. And a lot of people are comparing the show to Game of Thrones. I don't think just for like the political intrigue and the different dynamic characters, but since it's on FX, you have the blood, the sex, the nudity, the sheer amount of human misery that you can put on the screen that many modern audiences find entertaining. And with saying that, I think a big part of this show is the authenticity. So Hiroyuki Sanada is the Japanese lead of the show. He's been doing samurai fare and acting for decades. And his entrance into Hollywood, I believe, is probably The Last Samurai. And just over the years, with him playing different scientists and doctors and assassins, etc., he has seen how Hollywood has failed to really accurately showcase Japanese culture. So with him taking this role, he's also a producer on the show. He managed to bring in wig makers, master gestures, sword weapons makers, swordsmiths, etc., and bringing them to Canada to film this show. And he wanted to make sure that every Japanese character was portrayed by a Japanese actor. With the money that's that the Americans and have in terms of show making shows, this is probably one of the biggest productions for any Japanese period piece ever. So I think many of the cast and crew from Japan were at all with what they could do in the West, where there's just not the same influx of money for Japanese movies and TV shows. You would see a lot of high-end productions for anime because that has made a huge splash, but just for the live-action fare, it's just not the same. So they could really imbue this show with so much in terms of not just the sets, but just the way people moved and spoke, just on every level you could see how much Sonata helped propel like authenticity into the show. And another reason why they had to film outside of Japan was because the permits, and I think it was very difficult for them to film all over Japan, so they had to film in Canada.
Okay. Well, I'm trying to think. Sonata, ironically, I feel like the thing I remember him from is playing Kaneda in Sunshine. He's the captain who he goes
oh, that's
out
right.
to fix.
That's yeah, exactly.
He gets
yeah.
incinerated, but he was great in that. That was I remember him in that, and I've seen him in tons of other stuff, but he's got that kind of stoic
right
vibe to him.
So he was a bit of a childhood crush for my wife, but she says the way he acts, it hasn't changed over the decades. He's quite in terms of him being stoic and his manner and demeanor has been pretty consistent. So I knew him from Sunshine, and he was a doctor in Helix, and then he was an assassin in John Wick, and then he was an assassin in one of the Avenger movies. So, I mean, he's been typecast in the West. And I assume he's typecast here because in terms of playing Todanaga, he didn't really have to study much except falconry. Aside from that, he's the one that's schooling the younger actors and making sure that everyone knew how to speak and move in a certain way. So he was very hands-on. And then we have Cosmo Jarvis playing Blackthorn, who is utterly amazing. I've never seen him before unless he's like, I didn't recognize him. I saw him in interviews and he seemed very quiet and meek and mild mannered. And this character is just off the rails. Like, I mean, this
he's
Blackthorn.
He's in Peaky Blinders. He's got a great little role in Peaky Blinders as like an assassin, not an assassin, but he's like a rifle marksman that they break out of a lunatic asylum to assassinate someone. Who was in their regiment, you know, in the First World War. And he's, I just remember him constantly saying, bloody big bang or something, like, because they've told him that this is coming. And sorry to spoil Peaky Blinders, but yeah, they kind of like blow up the prison so he can escape. But yeah, that's the only other thing I really think I've seen him in, apart from maybe a Netflix romance film that my other half watched.
Yeah,
he was great in Peaky Blinders, though.
Well, seeing him in this, he reminded me so much of Tom Harding in terms of like the grizzled voice and the demeanor and just like take no shit from anyone. And it's just like he's like, I would say all the actors are like amazing, but him in particular, I mean, he just seems, I guess maybe the theme of this podcast would be just obsession and just confident. Like it just... no matter what was put in his way, he would overcome it. And it's quite interesting. And then they would also use that, you know, some of the dynamics in terms of seeing how the Japanese react to certain things opposed to, you know, an Englishman at that time.
Right.
As well as, you know, some things are considered cowardice when you see spoilers for the first 10 minutes of Shogun, but, you have Blackthorn's ship crashes, or like basically there's a fleet of possibly five Dutch ships, and his ship is the last remaining one. You know, out of like 500 crewmen, there's only maybe a handful left, and the captain commits suicide, and he saw that as cowardice. And then you have Seppuku on the other end, you know, where it's not considered cowardice, but if you fail at something or you dishonor someone, then you would kill yourself. But that's ingrained in the Japanese culture at that time. So just seeing those different dynamics, but you know, he's someone who would never give up or never would think of killing themselves. So, and it's very interesting to watch this guy, like just in every scene, he's amazing. And then you have Anna Sawai, who I've only seen in the new Monarch Godzilla show. And right after she filmed this show, she immediately started filming Monarch. And she's a tremendous actress who was born in New Zealand, raised in Japan, the Philippines, and Hong Kong, and then went back to Japan. And I assumed she was American just through her accent. So I assume she went to international schools. And just, again, looking at how the dynamic between how she portrayed, you know, I guess the dynamic between the character she played in Monarch and this one, again, night and day. And just, again, as someone else who's very formidable in terms of their intelligence, but also just keeping things close to the chest and just being on par with these men in at this time, you know, just going head to head with, you know, political leaders, as well as having to face off between the machinations of Catholics and Blackthorn. And then lastly, we have Ishido, who's played by Takahiro Hira. He's also in Monarch, and he played Sawai's father in that show. So it's very, very interesting because you've just seen so many Japanese shows recently that are actually really well done, like Tokyo Vice, Ninja Kamui. Now we have, you had Monarch. Now we have this one, you know, and it's great to see more of these shows coming to the forefront, but also having the audience who are willing to go with this, where you have a bilingual show, people are speaking English, however it's supposed to be Portuguese. And just, I think, again, like Game of Thrones, where you're not having to feed people much of anything. They're going for the ride and they're invested. And this show had a huge debut on Hulu and FX. So it's great that we're at a place where we can watch more international television and no one bats an eyelash and are engaged and, you know, have not having a show that talks down to the audience.
Yeah, hear, hear. How far through is it or are you?
So far, there's only been two episodes that aired.
Okay.
And this week, the next episode will drop. But it has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes at the moment. I don't think it had too much of a splash in terms of marketing, but there was a huge groundswell online as soon as it dropped. And just listening to my my wife and her brother, I mean they loved the show. There were some things they thought was like ridiculous, like when, you know, how quick someone was beheaded. You know, if they did something in the street and a head is rolls, or scenes where, you know, I guess, you know, again, another spoiler where you would have Blackthorn trading barbs with someone in Japanese and they can't understand each other, but they're kind of saying similar things. And then a Japanese, I guess, local leader pisses on his head and they would just say, oh, we would never do that. we wouldn't do anything like that. But again, you know, certain things are heightened. And then you could also, just with the way Jarvis approached the role, that he didn't want to know Japanese. So, but as his character started to understand more, he was studying more Japanese. And something that's unusual for most shows was that the show was filmed in order. So it was easy for him to do something like that. I'm really hoping that this gets a season two, but if it has, you know, with the reaction, hopefully they'll continue to do it. I think there's 8 books to the Shogun saga. So hopefully they'll continue to mine this and do more with it. But it's, I would recommend this to anyone. I think it was a bit iffy at first, you know, just looking at like, you know, maybe the first 20 minutes or so, but definitely once they really get into what's happening between the Portuguese and their, you know, the way they're trying to garner power in Asia and where Blackthorn fits in it, and just seeing, you know, how people want to execute him and others want to keep him around for various reasons. And just looking at that play and the dynamics on every level, it's just really hooked me. It's definitely worth watching. And I do think, I know everyone compares this or they try to compare it to Game of Thrones, but it's much more interesting to know that this is, you know, based on history. They changed the names in some of the events, but it sounds like in many ways it's historically accurate.
So we're not going to get a teenage girl firebombing a city with dragons, which is a relief.
Yeah, well, some would say.
I don't know. My Japanese history is not not as well, good. Well,
if you want to see that, maybe you can watch. Well, maybe you can watch Monarch. You can have that.
Okay. Okay. Well, two episodes in, lots of promise, lots of books. So, you know, guys, if you're looking to get in at the ground level on a new, a big show, this could be one to look at. Blackthorn is a not very good cider where I'm from, but it's a great name. So yeah, I'll add it to the ever growing list. Okay. All right, well, maybe more updates on that as the weeks go on. I'm going to start with a movie that I watched on Friday night, so a couple of days ago now. I seem to have a knack at the moment for punishing myself as a parent with the choices of movies that I make. Anatomy of a Fall is a movie that, first of all, I'll not spoil as much as possible. It was the Palme d'Or winner this year, so it's been around for a little while. The leading lady, Sandra Hüller, is also, from what I gather, has a very pivotal role in another film that I'm sure we'll be talking about soon, The Zone of Interest. And, I mean, if you've seen the poster for this film, then you probably have a good idea of what it's about. So this is only a very minor spoiler. In the first scene of the movie, someone dies. It appears that they fall out of the window of a house somewhere in, I believe, the French Alps near Grenoble. Although I only know it's Grenoble because they kept talking about Grenoble in the film. I don't really know exactly where that is. My geography is not amazing, but it was cold and in the mountains, so I assume it was the Alps. And the rest of the film is all about, not really a whodunit, but it's the fallout of this person who dies from the fall. It's interesting because it's set in France. The leading character, played by Sandra Hüller, is also called Sandra. She's a German woman who prefers to speak in English and lives in France. Her son is half German, half French, but prefers to speak in French. And her husband is the person that falls to his death within the first 5 minutes of the movie. So, and I believe he preferred to speak in French. So this is really a movie that eventually becomes a courtroom drama. And the main plot of this movie, or the main concept of this movie, really is whether or not Sandra is responsible for the death of her husband. And throughout the film, throughout the aforementioned Anatomy of the Fall, we're presented with no real evidence, but lots of anecdotal information. And we gradually delve deeper into this family's life. There is lots of references to things we talked about last time in terms of lost men, men who feel they maybe haven't fulfilled their potential, jealousy of all sorts within a relationship, I suppose questionable parenting. The child in question, Daniel, is actually, I think, legally blind in the story as a result of events that occurred before the movie, which, again, there's sort of parental responsibility thrown into the mix there. Daniel's played by Milo Mercado-Granna in a very good role. He really convinces as an 11-year-old boy, and my eldest son, as I might have alluded to earlier, actually turned 11 this weekend. So watching the film that has some hard moments, you know, a child who's lost his sight and then loses his father, I will freely admit that, you know, there was a few tears throughout this movie. It's an interesting one. It's a great film. The writer-director, Justin Trier, and I believe she wrote it with her partner, Arthur Harari, you know, they've constructed a very gripping narrative all the way through the film. I was questioning, you know, whether or not this woman was responsible for her husband's death in any way, you know, be that literally or through their relationship. Layers of the onion appealed throughout. We get an interesting look in the French legal system, which actually I wasn't that familiar with. It's a little different to how it works in England, and subtle differences to what you'd see in an American courtroom drama, just in terms of, it seems like there's a lot more interrupting that goes on in a French courtroom, which actually makes for quite interesting scenes. And yeah, I mean, all of the actors are on amazing form. it pulls you through, but it's so focused on where it's going. I don't really want to spoil anything. Suffice to say, yeah, it's a very interesting story that will pull you through. If you're in a long-term relationship, you will recognize lots of the struggles that come with that. If you're a parent, you'll recognize lots of the struggles that come with that. And I suppose, you know, one of the things that this film has got maybe unexpected praise for recently is the performance of the canine actor Messi, who plays Le Chien, which I believe means the dog, although I did German when I was studying, not French. But yeah, the dog gives a fantastic performance as well. And I believe he's been on the red carpet in Hollywood this week, you know, rubbing shoulders with Benji and Lassie and Ryan Gosling. So yeah, I would highly recommend it. But I'll be honest, I went into it not even knowing what I've explained at this point. You know, I'd seen the poster, a kind of dead body in the snow. So I've assumed based on that and the title that it was going to be something to do with the fallout of a death, but beyond that I knew nothing. And I think that was a good way to go into it. And you know, everyone in the film feels very real. It's palpable the sort of stress that this woman goes through as the focus of I don't want to say a murder trial, but you know, a trial about her husband's death. And it handles it in a very realistic narrative fashion.
I first became aware of Anatomy of Fall through the Golden Globes. I didn't see any trailers. I didn't see the poster. But just some of the comments that were made by one of the winners for the movie really intrigued me. And just some of the themes that they mentioned made me really interested in seeing this movie. So I didn't know a thing about it. And this is the first time I heard really what it was about. So I'm definitely going to watch this when it drops on a streamer. There's just so many movies. And, you know, as you said, the list is growing longer and longer. But this is something that's on top of my list. That ends on an interest again. And that was my interest grew because of what you mentioned about what you knew about Zone of Interest.
Yeah, I mean, snow seems to be a good indicator this year because The Holdovers was a good movie. Society of the Snow was a good movie. This movie features a lot of snow. So I guess if you're looking to cull some from the pack, then look for snow because that seems to be a sure sign of success this year. Yeah, I would recommend it, definitely. It's, you know, it's a thrilling film, very much in the mold of... It reminded me of Michael Haneke's films to some degree, you know, that kind of mature, patient, European drama thriller. You know, it's not nail-biting. There's no car chases in it, but psychologically it's incredibly engaging. And I mean, it's 2.5 hours long, but that time went by pretty quickly and just everyone in it is utterly convincing. And as I often say, I appreciate being less familiar with actors that come from, you know, places that aren't Hollywood, because it just immediately allows me to engage with the story rather than thinking about, you know, what a great performance Brad Pitt's giving or Margot Robbie's giving. And not to detract from those actors as talented people, but I do think Hollywood sometimes is a victim of its own oversaturation. Movies like this and Society of the Snow, where I didn't really know any of the actors very, very much before going into it, it just adds a layer of authenticity to it that I really appreciate. One thing I will throw to you, though, as a result of the performance by Messi, the dog, in this movie, I did put together a top 5 movie dogs, and, you know, feel free to interject. At number 5, we've got Beethoven. Of course, you know, his ability to slobber on command is right up there with Walter Matthau. I don't know the name, but I think he's just called Dog from Up. And I know that's not a real dog, but still, he's just so loyal. He reminds me of an old friend of ours called John. Blood, the dog called Blood from A Boy and His Dog, which had a young, what's his name? Nash Bridges. Don Johnson, a young Don Johnson in it. Great post-apocalyptic movie, by the way, if you want to check it out. It would be a good double bill with Hell Comes to Frogtown. Turner, that's a classic. Turner and Hooch. That is a classic. Turner from Turner and Hooch, which is another one I would say, like, if you, you know, if you want a sort of late 80s romp, Tom Hanks before he got all serious, certainly the Tom Hanks I prefer. Turner and Hooch, great, great buddy movie. But for me, the best dog actor, aside from Messi in Anatomy of a Fall, is the dog from The Thing. I think he's, you know, he's about 80% wolf, gives one of the most chilling performances in movie history. Who's your favorite dog, BC?
Who's my favorite dog?
Or did we cover it?
I don't think Ravage is a dog. Ravage from the Transformers. I think he's a panther. That's my
I'll give you
dog.
That one.
He looks like a dog.
All right. Well, from one courtroom to the next, I predict. Yeah. What have you got for us next, BC?
I mean, this is high stakes. Free V's, jury duty. I don't know how big this show is now. Like, I only knew about this through the Golden Globes and the Emmys, just with all the award nods for writing, best supporting, I believe it's best supporting comedic actor for James Marsden. But basically, this is kind of like a mashup of so much, and it makes so much sense of like a culmination of so many years of, you know, mockumentary comedies, The Truman Show. Mm-hmm. Then you have the fair of like The Rehearsal, Nathan For You, How To with John Wilson, where it's kind of scripted, but not, right? And then, you know, and then you really have the Borat movies, right? And Ali G, mm-hmm. where you put, again, normal people into semi-scripted situations. So this falls under the reality TV category. But it's, I think it's well done. How funny it is, it's, you know, something else. But I think the right. Genius behind it is, you know, remarkable. Basically, in 2001, over 2,500 people applied to take part in a documentary-style project about jury duties on Craigslist. And out of all those people, they picked one person, and his name is Ronald Gladden. So basically, Gladden is part of a jury for a ridiculous trial, and all the fellow jurors, the lawyers, everyone in the courtroom and possibly in the courthouse are all actors or writers, producers, etc. So kind of true to the Truman Show. He's a real person, not aware of the ridiculous circumstances that he's surrounded by is fake. So essentially, you're watching Gladden react to the most bizarre situations, you know, something out of The Office or even more heightened, like Parks and Rec. You're observing his reactions, and you're kind of judging him based on his interactions with other people. And also you're judging him as a juror. So while he was sequestered for 17 days in his hotel with limited access to the outside world, he really got into the role unknowingly as the foreman of the jury. So, I mean, it has its funny moments, but they really picked someone who I could say who had the patience and compassion to really like just witness the craziest things that, you know, one would expect and still maintain his humanity. So,
yeah,
it's a brilliant show on many levels, where just where the writers had to constantly keep up with what he did day after day or hour after hour, or how much he got into the role as juror. And you had the actors who also had to kind of keep up with them and then be in character for days on end as they interacted with Ronald. And even when mistakes were made, they had to play it off. Scripts had to be rewritten, and as well as you had cameras everywhere. or props men going in and out of rooms when Ronald left. It's quite dynamic. And for a show on a streamer that no one watched, it basically became popular on TikTok and on social right. media, like these clips. And that's how people found this show until it became quite popular. So I still don't know how many people watched it or how big it was, but I mean, it did get many, many award nods and won a couple Spirit Awards. I think one for Best Reality Show and Best Ensemble. I mean, it's garnered recognition, and I don't know if there's another show like it coming, but they really populated the jury with actors, or also former lawyers who looked real, who reflected LA. So it was quite the diverse cast, as well as you had, you know, legal experts in some of these roles who could, you know, also be writers and consultants while they made the show. And when you watch it, you'll recognize some of these people from movies or small parts on TV shows or commercials. So you see right. them around, or you will see them coming up in bigger things. One of the reasons why I believe this works is because of the producers. One of the producers worked on the Borat movies and worked with closely with Sacha Baron Cohen on Who Is America. And then another producer worked on a number of comedies. Is also is Dan Harmon's partner. So
right.
So Cody
Heller. Romantic partner?
Romantic partner.
Right,
so
right.
She really has. And so she has some comedy chops, as well as, you know, has a prolific partner who's, you know, considered godlike in the comedy world. I would say that Donald Gladden, who is a solar panel installer and a Home Depot project manager, really lucked out when he applied for this role on Craigslist.
Yeah, he's such a nice guy. It's such an interesting concept. Like, I agree with you. It's not really that funny, but in a way, I don't know how it could have been, because if you had a more volatile character or a more volatile human in his shoes, you know, fights might have broken out. Like, it could have turned really bad, and sure, that would have probably made for an amusing 5 minutes, but they wouldn't have had a show after that point. But on the flip side, because he just seems to be able to roll with any punch that life throws him, he's so benign. He's so willing to, you know, assist these people. And, you know, with the exception of James Marsden, they've cast sure faces that you kind of recognize, but they look like real people. They're very convincing. And their characters, I found them a little heightened, but I haven't spent that much time in LA, and I do sort of suspect that maybe if I did, I don't know, you know, I really don't know. I'm not, you know, all joking aside, I'm not familiar enough with day-to-day America that, you well, know, maybe I mean, some of these people, you know,
but some of the antics, I mean, like, yeah, James Marsden being like, you know, an arrogant, you know, self-obsessed actor. I mean, fine. And I mean, that's kind of funny. But then they looked at like 505,000 actors or people yeah. to be jurors, right? People of all stripes. They wanted that cast to look like LA. But as you said, it's heightened. So, I mean, I don't know how much of the show you did see. Like, you know, the guy that's, you know, connected to Ronald's room in the hotel, like, is obsessed with, like, you know, body augmentation, and some of the stuff that he does is, like, insane, you know, or in the courtroom, right? Like, it's, you know, things like that where it's just like, or I don't know if you saw the soaking.
Right.
And I learned about soaking years ago because that went viral, like, years ago, and just reading about, you know, what, you know, Mormon teens did right before marriage.
It just reminded me, yeah.
So, I mean, just some of those things are just, you know, and he, like I said, he rolls with the punches. And then there's other scenes where, you know, people, you know, lose their shit and just how he reacts to all that. And, you know, I think most people would walk away, you know, or wouldn't associate with some of these people. But he made a concerted effort to really, you know, ingratiate himself and bond with those fellow jurors.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's insanity.
It's insanity, but I think that's it's an experiment, and what comes from the experiment is that they found this incredibly nice guy, and I think that's a nice story to experience in current times, where, you know, we maybe can easily tend to cynicism and bleakness, and, you know, he was a good guy. I mean, I'm subjected to other experiment shows in my house because, you know, my partner's a huge fan of things like Love is Blind and The Ultimatum. And listen, I'm not going to pretend that I'm better than I am. Like, I watch them with her, and I, after a couple of episodes, you know, I'm shouting at the TV too. But those kinds of experiments are basically experiments on how quickly you can turn someone into an Instagram star or an influencer, and they're ultimately far more cynical. But this was, in the end, while not being laugh out loud funny, it was a pleasant reminder that there are some good people out there who will, you know, go the distance for people that they've just met. And, you know, yeah, I didn't finish it, but I think I watched all but one episode. I don't know why I didn't finish it. Something came up and it just maybe wasn't gripping enough for me to go back to. I didn't intentionally cut it off, but I think, you know, Ronald covering for James Marsden's dump was definitely one of the highlights of last year.
I think that was the episode that got the Oscar. Oh, no, sorry. I think that was the episode that got the Emmy nod for best writing. And then the guy with the glasses, I think he's one of the writers on the show. Yeah, I think it's worth watching.
Definitely.
Yeah, in terms of your humor, the miles would vary. But I mean, I'm glad I watched it, and I watched it until the end. I mean, but yeah, some of it's a bit like, okay, whatever. But then, you know, what are you going to do if you're like filming and rolling, like, you know, 24/7, you know, trying to, you know, compile something together, right?
Yeah, and it convinces me more that it is authentic, that it's less funny. I think I would have maybe trusted it less. Again, I won't go back down the reality TV road, but so much that presents itself as reality is complete, you know, farce and clearly isn't true. You know, you can tell. One of the things I notice on a lot of the reality shows on Netflix, and they even allude to it, is the use of opaque glasses when people are drinking, because they edit it so out of sequence that, you know, you would see the level of someone's drink changing in a very unusual fashion if they just actually edited it chronologically. And the minute that came into existence, it was like, well, this is all clearly, you know, lies. And,
right,
you know, you can edit a reaction to something completely different. Reminds me of Rain Man, you know, like when Dustin Hoffman answers the question and Tom Cruise is like, he's answering a question from 30 minutes ago. But that's a complete tangent. That's what reality TV is now.
Yeah, well, reality TV plays in the house. I think my family's obsessed with Traitors, and I haven't looked at it. And it's huge. Like, I guess there was a British version, and now there's an American version, and it's so big. And then, like, you know, in terms of the streaming charts, how many people are watching, and like kids and wife are obsessed with it, and I just walk out the room.
But it's good, you know, we can go and read a book, or, I mean, for me, I would probably play a video game, and I'm sure my other half frowns on how much time I spend playing Zelda, you know, so to each their own. Yeah, I'll definitely finish it off. And I mean, in that vein, the next thing that I want to talk about is Nathan Fielder is heavily involved with, of course, and he was responsible for Nathan For You and the rehearsal. I've just started watching The Curse. I'm aware that you finished it. I think I'm 4 or 5 episodes in. The Curse stars Nathan Fielder, Emma Stone, Benny Safdie, and Corbin Burnson's cock.
Not a real one.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. That's a stunt cock.
Yeah,
I thought that's how he made his big comeback. I thought like Jury Duty, they went through 5,000 people in the casting, and they were like, Corbin, that's the cock for us.
I know. I mean, in auditions, it's nothing but, you know, dick pics, you know.
So the curse is, it's a bit like with the rehearsal. I think if you read the synopsis, I won't say that you're going to be disappointed, but you're just going to be very quickly blindsided. You know, it's about two, again, reality TV people who are, I mean, they're not stars because they're making their first reality TV show. And I think that element of it threw me straight away because I thought they were going to be like more established, but they are renovating houses. They're trying to sell these kind of modern eco homes that look horrendous. They look like something out of a, you know, a terrible sci-fi movie or, you know, from the late 70s, these kind of weird mirror houses, but that's not really the point. I mean, I'm sure there's definitely some metaphorical level to renovation of homes and homes being bought on Native American land. Of course, at some point early on, Nathan Fielder, who is skin crawlingly perpetually awkward in everything that he does, encounters two young girls who are selling cans of soda in a parking lot. The director of the reality TV show that they're making says, go and to make yourself look more benevolent. He gets involved with these girls. He gives them a $100 bill because that's all he's got in his wallet. The minute he opens his wallet and you see all he's got is $100, you know that at some point he's going to try and get it back. Of course he does. The little girl puts a curse on him. And from that point on, this show just moves into realms of dread and unsettling music, excessively slow, lingering zooms on people doing kind of arbitrary things that put you on edge. Emma Stone using every muscle in her face to evoke awkwardness and frustration to thrilling effect. I actually think, in a way, having watched Poor Things recently, I think her performance in The Curse so far might actually be better. It's less showy, but it's a masterclass in human awkwardness, and you could just really read so much on her face. This kind of awkward relationship that they purport to be in love with each other, but I don't get much of that from them so far. Benny Safdie is this kind of depressed, semi-failed film director, and let me just say what an actor this man is. The three or four roles I've seen him in, he is an absolute chameleon. He was in the Safdie brothers' breakthrough. You know, he was the Robert Pattinson's deaf younger brother. What was that movie called? Is it Good Time? But he was kind of thuggish, brutish in that movie. Then he played a politician. I think he played Harvey Milk in something or someone similar. Maybe it wasn't Harvey Milk, but he played a politician, I think, in Licorice Pizza last year. And then he turned up in this and I didn't recognize him at first. He's, you know, he's got the kind of 90s alternative grunge haircut and like the ripped jeans and the beard. And then I'm like, oh, that's Benny Safdie. And I'm just like, this guy, based on what I've seen so far, he can do anything. And I believe he was in Oppenheimer, but, you know, I obviously still haven't watched that. So it's a bit like, I don't want to say a bad smell, but maybe more like an open wound that you can't stop scratching. You know, it's like, I don't really like what's happening, but I can't stop looking at it. And I do want to know what's coming. And I do want to see what's going to happen next. But I just know that it's just going to get more and more uncomfortable and skin crawling and awkward. And just so that you don't spoil anything, and I'll try not to either, but I'm up. I just got to the point where they've, let's say, he's entered the house with a drill. So the girl, this won't make any sense to anyone, actually. The girl has confessed to stealing his chicken. And he's like, and maybe that doesn't mean anything to you either.
No, it does. It does.
And that really, that was a great moment, actually. It was like, oh, okay, yeah. I see what's going on.
I think, or rather, I think at that point, I was like, look, there's so many things to say. Yeah. And then I'll try to get to address what you just said about the drill. One, you talk about the slow prodding, you know, like the lingering camera, and that was a nod to Columbo, apparently. Like,
they were, wow.
So old episodes of Columbo, okay. Like, they would say, like, you know, Columbo needed to make a phone call. So now you would cut it out, right? Like, you just trim everything. You would just watch Columbo, like, turn a dial, wait for someone to pick up, have the conversation hang up. It just, you know, just all that is just on film. Like, for what, you know? So I don't know why, but I guess they thought that was amusing. Also, the show, I guess they got the idea from when someone really cursed Nathan. He was at a shop, and I can't remember if he didn't want to give, basically he didn't want to give someone money or something to that effect. And then they said, "I curse you."
I've been cursed. I've been cursed. Yeah. Yeah. The, I won't say what pejorative name they used to go by in the town that I grew up in, but there were ladies, I believe probably of Romani descent that would, that would walk up and down the streets with sprigs of, I don't know, herbs and some flowers wrapped up in tinfoil, and they'd try and sell them to you for, you know, like the equivalent of like $4 or $5. And I remember trying to impress a girl that I was seeing at the time. I thought that she would appreciate my charitable gesture. It was a very Nathan Fielder moment, actually. Completely like disingenuous generosity. I was kind of like, oh yeah, I'll take one. And she kind of, you know, looked at me as if to say, there's another step to this transaction. So I think I got like a small amount of change out, and she was sort of like, £2, mate. And I was like, I don't have that. And then she was like, I curse you, like that. So, and I mean, since then, things haven't been great. I'm not going to lie. So,
well, I was just saying, I forgot my mom cursed me too. So my mom,
we've all been cursed.
What did my mother say? I can't remember what I did or what was going on, but then I just remember her saying, like, I wish you would have children just like you. And I'm not going to respond to how it turned out.
Yeah, I'm going to choose to be diplomatic at this point. I will take the fifth.
So yeah, I've been cursed. But yeah, this show is, I think they described it as anxiety horror. And you watch the interviews with the cast, and it's kind of funny. They're very just kind of benign about the whole thing. Like, it's just, I don't know if it was just like them throwing like all the craziness against the wall and seeing what sticks. But I mean, you watch, I mean, it's, you know, it's very methodical in what they did in terms of the approach and the filmmaking, and, you know, the caliber acting. I mean, well, primarily from Emma Stone, who's amazing. I think, you know, I think as the show goes on, I think she's the one that you're really like observing. I mean, because Nathan, he's like awkward and weird. And I mean, there's growth in his character. And so with the, I don't know what you call it, the director, I would say, yeah, but is he director of this?
The hanger-on.
Yeah, I don't know. Showrunner? It's like showrunner. I'm not sure what you call him. Producer?
I think, that's what he calls himself.
But yeah, she's the most interesting out of like everyone in that show, and watching her turmoil, her frustration. And it's very interesting and very like, it's sad. It goes back to what you were saying. Like, are these people in love, not in love? Like, you know, you have these two people in constant conflict. And I guess conflict is good for storytelling, but this is like such another level of just painfulness. And there's a reality to it in terms of people who are married and together, and do you separate? And then you have so much invested, like not just their time they've been together, but the money, you know, all of it. And it's just, you know, trauma after trauma and weird incident after incident. And in many ways it's funny, but it's not. And it's similar to many of the comedies that are popular now, like The Bear. I mean, this is next level, but these shows are considered comedies, but then how much of it is really funny? And this just takes it to like another cringe level, you know, purposely so. takes a lot of time and endurance to watch it. Because for me, you know, I'm watching it because not that I'm enjoying it, and not particularly because I like the characters, but I think I'm such a fan of Nathan Fielder, and it's just, I want to see, you know, like it's art to a certain extent, right? And I think based on the next thing we'll talk about, you know, it's not about having answers for anyone or anything like that. You're watching, like, these artists put these things out there and you observe and you make your own opinions. But I think I want to see more shows like this or from him. So I'm willing to give my time and energy to watch it, no matter how experimental or weird or painful it can be, because it's an endurance match. But I think that I'm willing to invest my time in the shows that Nathan Fielder makes.
And I mean, listen, watch the third series of Twin Peaks, and this comparatively is like an episode of Roseanne, you know. I mean, Nathan Fielder's definitely pushing some envelopes, but yeah, like, we just need to go back to David Lynch to really experience, you know, am I watching paint dry? Am I watching art? I've really, sometimes I don't know. But yeah, there was a moment, I think, in the last episode that I watched where, I don't know if it was intentional, but it was such a great comment on modern society. She gets stuck in her sweater. He helps her out. They have a nice moment. And she says, "This is us." And then her instinct is to grab her camera, reenact it, and try and film it again. And of course they can't. And it ends up leading to a quite unpleasant argument. And I've been in that swing from wonderful moment with the person you love to horrible argument over the span of like 15 minutes where you're like, how the hell did that just happen? And it's almost always over something so trivial. But the fact that the mechanism that they used for that scene was this idea of setting up a social media post, which I'm sure must happen so often. You know, all these social media posts you see that look like footage from those old, you know, video camera shows that we used to watch in the 80s and 90s, you know, the baby falling over, or at the moment people throwing slices of cheese at babies seems to be a thing on social media. But you know, it's probably the third or fourth time this thing's been done, and all the kind of honesty and magic of the moment is gone. And you get to this point where you're actually arguing over, like, you know, like Orson Welles or something, you know, like yelling at your partner, like, no, you've got to take the sweater off, more comedically. And it's insane. And I think this obsession with looking at ourselves is definitely something that they're tapping into with this show, as well as obviously being lovers of film and television. So they're very aware at how we've looked at ourselves for the past 100 years as students of the art form. But now, you know, and for the past 10 years or so, we've all had cameras in our hands constantly. So we're all, you know, like Dr. Brown was saying, Back to the Future, we're carrying around TV studios in our pockets. And that scene, it kind of came out of nowhere and doesn't immediately link to anything else in the show, but it was such a great scene and so tragic, really, because you can just see so many of the decisions they make in this show are about the perception of themselves that they've presented either on TV or on film or to other people and to each other. It's really interesting. So yeah, it's anxiety horror, I think, is a good name for it. And I found it more horrific than a lot of horror films that I've watched. Not because there's monsters or anything like that. There's nothing particularly disgusting in it apart from Corbin Burnson's cock. But yeah, it's horrific. It's unsettling. You know, both me and my partner, we've agreed that we can't watch it right before bed because, you know, we have like really fitful sleep after watching an episode of The Curse we're not really sure why.
Yeah, the finale gave me nightmares.
I think maybe it's the new moral panic. Like if you watch the Curse backwards, it's going to be like, "Hail Satan," you know?
when you were talking about drills and stolen chickens. No, but you mentioned that, like, I think as I watched that show, and like you said, it's what, fourth or fifth episode, I kept feeling like thinking, when is this over? How many more episodes? And then you're saying that's only the fourth or fifth. And I'm like, man, like, it's just, there's so much more that happens. Even when you mentioned like one of the scenes in a scene about drunk driving in the second episode. And I was like, that was only the second episode?
Yeah.
like it is. It's a lot.
It really is. It's a lot. It's not bingeable. Put it that way. I think I kind of watched two episodes and I'm like, that's enough for now. Like, I need to take a break from this show. But that's good too. You know, I think that's important. I think I do think a good showrunner distinguishes their episodes. You know, and I like it. I like the feeling of an episode as a part of a bigger picture, but also kind of encapsulated into itself. I think that's an important thing to do. Anyway, I haven't even finished it yet, so I'll stop talking about it for now. And that would bring us squarely to the main event, the final text to discuss. We both watched. Do you want to summarize Saltburn, or do you want me to summarize Saltburn? I'm feeling generous, so.
You know, Emerald Fennel.
Or should we both summarize it?
Yeah, we both can. You know, we both can. But Emerald Fennel, you know, thought about someone saying, "I love you emphatically." I believe that's like the first line, or "I love him emphatically," which I think is the first line from the beginning of the movie. And then subsequently thought of someone drinking bath water from a drain. And that was her inspiration for this movie. Oh, this period piece is set in Oxford, 2006. Yeah, it's about a student who goes to Oxford and ingratiates himself with a very wealthy family. And the student is on a scholarship and stands out because he doesn't have the money or the wealth as his peers. But he makes a good impression on his fellow student, Felix. And Felix welcomes Kuigan's character, Oliver Quick, to his home for the summer. And when I say home, I mean his castle estate.
Saltburn. Which sounds vaguely sexual, but it's just the name of a manor.
Well, Saltburn supposedly is an area in the UK, but that's actually why Fennel chose the name Saltburn, because she said it sounded like some kind of pain you get from sex. And I think sex is a big part of this movie, where Fennel believes that sex is imbued in everything that we do. And that definitely comes to play in this movie, but it's, you know, it symbolizes power and weakness, and in every facet we yearn for it in one way or another. Love. So I would say this movie is about obsession, but many of the machinations that come at play is through heightened sexuality. So yeah, this is up there with other similar movies with people possibly eating the rich, going after them, or trying to take them down, like Parasite, Triangle of Sadness. What's another one?
Society.
The menu.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Society's eating the poor. Yeah. Society's the inverse of this.
That's true. But yeah, it's it's a very interesting, beautiful, well-acted movie, with every scene and every line of dialogue having importance. Because I didn't know much about Saltburn, it's kind of like the holdovers. I saw the trailer and I was like, oh, this is not for me. And then I think once it went on streaming, and just again with some of the buzz it got around the Golden Globes, and everyone's talking about, you know, the nudity and some of the theories behind what was happening in the movie. It intrigued me. I know we had a discussion and you had your take. I wanted to watch something that we both watched, so I chose this movie to watch yesterday.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely very happy that I watched it, and I really analyzed it. And I think on that level, in terms of the, like, the craft, cinematography, the writing, all the symbolism from almost in almost every scene, background, all of it, it's very well done. But since I didn't like any of the characters, and at some points when I found it so unrelatable that I grew bored, that really detract from all the, like, the craftsmanship. And again, and kind of like The Curse, I liked it because, you know, the answer is up to the audience, like, how, whatever you take from it or how you interpret it, like, what, you know, what's your take? I thought it's something that I wouldn't go back to per se, but I do think it's a very well done movie. And I think just depending on who you are, like, you would see the rich in a different light, or, you know, or enjoy some of, you know, it's more of the thriller aspects of it. Like, if you're really looking at everything and trying to peel apart what's happening, it can be enjoyable. But this is a gothic, you know, romantic, I don't want to say thriller, I don't want to say horror, but I guess it's a gothic romance, more or less.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, and maybe I misread some of the hype. I think I went into this expecting, I didn't expect it to be a classic, but I felt like that's the way people were talking about it, where really, I don't think it has a great deal to say about anything other than, you know, the rich are empty and hoard their wealth and, you know, maybe like to invite less rich people into their world to flaunt it and toy with them. But really, it's on a similar kind of narrative level to something like Knives Out in a way. You know, it's not quite a whodunit, but it's that kind of, I feel like the structure and the machinations build more towards that kind of a climax than anything particularly deep and meaningful and philosophical. I mean, I think a film that it made me think of in terms of a lower class person, you know, infiltrating, shall we say, very rich and wealthy people, is an old British movie called Kind Hearts and Coronets, which is part of the great wave of Ealing comedies. It features an actor called Dennis Price as a not low class, but lower class gentleman who discovers that he's sort of 10th in line to the height of this famous rich family and decides to methodically ingratiate himself and slowly murder them all. And it's a comedy. It's a black comedy, probably one of the earliest truly black comedies, and Alec Guinness plays about 8 parts in it, and he's fantastic. Martin Scorsese said that he stole the voiceover narration structure from Kind Hearts and Coronets for Goodfellas, so it's worth watching just to make that comparison. But it's a similar kind of idea, but the main character is so much more likable, and that's not a slight to Barry Keoghan, who I think has been fantastic in everything that he's done. And he's got a real niche for, you know, I suppose you might say misfits or outsiders. He's an unusual, I think, looking gentleman. And in a way that, like, David Bowie or someone like that was, you know, he certainly catches the eye. And I've always felt that. But, like, I've never really felt a link with any of the characters he's played. They seem like people that are maybe a step removed from me, you know, not relatable. Even Nathan Fielder in his awkwardness, I could relate to at times. But Barry Keoghan has this knack for characters that he can embody and really give everything to. And they're memorable and striking and incredibly well acted. But I couldn't relate to him throughout this film at all. A little bit at the start, maybe. But,
right,
you know, without spoiling anything, that kind of quickly changes. In the end, I think Jacob Elordi's character, who at first I thought was just a typical empty-headed British upper-class socialite, which he kind of is, but he seems ultimately nice enough. Like, he sort of toys with people a bit, but he's not really, his heart's not in it. He just seems to be, I don't want to say stuck in this rich world, but, you know, he's fallen into it through birth. He didn't choose it. He's kind of making the most of socializing with it. And listen, you know, most of us would kill for that problem. But he is likable in the film. He takes Barry Keoghan's character in. I think I want to believe that he means well with it. And I think it's maybe the insidious kind of comments of people around him that maybe turn people against, turn Oliver against Felix. I'm not sure. But yeah, like you said, I just don't really like anyone in this story. And I don't think it's just because they're mostly wealthy. Everyone seems very empty. I don't know what anyone really wants from life in this film.
I think that Fennel went to Oxford. And listening to the British cast, I think they have certain perceptions of the wealthy where they are unemotional because they were raised in boarding schools with people who didn't care about them. And, you know, everything's considered fodder. And then Felix... As much he is, I think he, as you said, he's nice and fairly benign, but then he also a bit of a hypocrite in terms of the way you would watch Felix's mother interact with a guest at her house, Pamela, and then with Oliver as well, in terms of in some ways genuinely interested in, you know, the plights of these people who don't have as much money as they do, but also kind of mining their misery or being entertained by their misery.
Right.
Like, oh, you know, your parents don't have this or they're addicts that, and just kind of mining it. And so some of it could be genuine, like in terms of from Felix wanting to truly befriend Oliver. But there's another part of it where it's like just being entertained, you know, or kind of,
yeah,
going on, experiencing these things through someone else.
Yeah, slumming. And I think there's a scene in the movie which didn't actually strike me this way at the time, but she is Rosamund Pike, who's great. You know, she does a great job,
yes,
as the matriarch. And she seems to be an actor who can flip between 30 and 50 with ease. But she's kind of the real power in that household. Richard E. Grant, the husband, is kind of a bit, you know, he's in the background, and she's talking about whether the song Common People by Pulp was written about her. And she obviously brings the subject up and denies it. But it's interesting because obviously that song is all about, you know, a rich girl who wants to sleep with common people and kind of wants to rough it for a bit to see what it's like. And I suppose, right, in a way that's,
yes,
kind of the plot of this movie.
Yes.
So
yeah,
I would say I know people that went to Oxford. I know rich British people. I lived in a pretty normal middle-class town when I was growing up, but on the outskirts there were lots of big manor houses and lots of people who went to public school and played rugby and spoke exactly like Felix. The use of the word mate in the mouth of a richer person I've always found amusing, because it's quite a working class expression to refer to someone as mate, but rich people kind of say it like, oh hey mate, oh that's so sad, oh that's so tragic mate, you know. And it's very like they're putting on and using, right, the language of the working class. And I think they did that quite convincingly. And I definitely got a real jolt of nostalgia watching this film. The music, the visuals, you know, a lot of the countryside was very familiar. You know, I didn't go to any parties to the level of Saltburn, but I definitely went to parties out in the English countryside in that sort of time. So there was a nice burst of nostalgia. And I do think it's where it's not being ridiculous, like with the butler character, it's a fairly believable portrayal of the upper classes in England. But I'm pretty sure, you know, I could be completely wrong and this should be fact checked, but I'm pretty sure a lot of the people involved, like Emerald Fennel and Rosamund Pike, I'm sure this was not a million miles away from their life. It's a bit of a club, England, you know, and people that went to Oxford and people that went to Cambridge, they are in, or historically at least, were in positions in the media. And, you know, if you listen to a lot of British actors, they controlled a lot of what was broadcast and, you know, what small amount of film was made in England was often part of this kind of club of public school people. I mean, like Monty Python, those guys, I think they were all either Oxford or Cambridge. You know, it's something that's kind of pervaded British culture for years, for better or for worse. So it's interesting. Maybe I wanted to see the axe swung at it a little bit harder. I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, Pike said that, you know, the joy of playing Elsbeth was that it was her way of getting back at people of that stature, class. I don't know a better word to choose at the moment, but yeah, it was her way of, like, you know, poking at them, because she encountered a lot of them, apparently. And then you had, I would say Farley, played by Archie Medicue. He's, I would say, kind of a rival to Oliver, where he's Felix's cousin. Basically, Farley's mother squandered the money in America, and Felix's parents basically allowed Farley to stay with them and attend Oxford and pay for his enrollment there. But since he's also not quite at the same level as the rest of the Cattons,
yeah,
there's a bit of gamesmanship between Oliver and Farley, where Farley doesn't have the money, but he knows the rules and kind of
right.
can mingle with people who are of the wealthy or amongst the wealthy. And then we also have Felix's sister. Her name is Vintia. She has, I would say, basically some issues.
Poor impulse control.
That, and also issues with eating. And Vintia has some issues with eating disorders, and that's one of her struggles. However, she seems to be one of the more perceptive members of the Cotton clan.
Yeah, for sure. I think the actress is called Alison Oliver, maybe. Yeah, she was very good. Listen, it's a very engaging movie. Throughout the movie, I wanted to know what was going to happen next. It pulled me along. You know, it's well-paced. I really enjoyed the choice of more square TV-style aspect yes. ratio.
Yep.
It never felt uncinematic, but it there was a lot of great moments where you were incredibly close on, you know, Barry Keoghan's face, and I was just thinking, there's someone standing in the, you know, in the corner watching you, like, I'm sure there is. And sometimes there was, sometimes there wasn't, but that kept things tense and added to that sense that he was infiltrating, you know, a world that he didn't belong to. And, you know, we were always kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop for him. And yeah, it was a really effective tool. You know, it wasn't just a gimmick. It worked very well for the film. And it also gave it this feeling of something being viewed in the past. You know, the story uses a voiceover narration quite sparingly, but we are looking back on a time past. And,
and
it feels like Polaroids, you know. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no. And I was going to say, it eventually will lead to the present.
Right.
So,
yes.
It's a very interesting journey. Oliver is likened to a vampire. And
yeah.
He really shifts and changes over time. As you said, that the first 20, 30 minutes is the most relatable in terms of when he was, you know, trying to ingratiate himself with friends at college, and, you know, he's, you know, stands out and, you know, kind of amongst the less popular students, and then him kind of falling in with the in crowd. But once they get to Saltburn, it's completely different. So Keoghan basically had different notebooks for different stages of Oliver's journey. In Saltburn, where there is at times where it seems like he performs some sort of rituals and really changes, and just as he obsesses over his possible love for Felix, as well right. as the clan. So it's interesting, but then you can just see how he learns to navigate this world. And again, yeah. a lot of it's, you know, not just about money, but it's power and power dynamics through slights and karaoke and, songs and tons and tons of sex implied or actually happening in one way, shape, or form. But you're just watching him navigate his parasitic way through Saltburn.
Yeah.
And it comes down to, do we think that these people deserve it or not? I mean, I guess that's one of the questions.
Definitely. There are attempts to make them relatable. Something I noticed is two or three times in this ginormous manner, they seem to gravitate towards this one room that is the room in the house that probably looks most like a lounge or a living room in a normal person's house. And they're gathered around a TV that, you know, probably would have been relatively big back in the early aughts, but, you know, by today's standards, it's just kind of normal. And they're watching, I think, Superbad, and they're watching the remake of The Ring. And I think not only do those films set it in a certain time, but there is something relatable about that. Like, how many people were sitting around watching those movies on a sofa, whether you were super rich or not? You know, you can only occupy a certain amount of space. You might have a huge house, but ultimately, when we're feeling our most calm and you know, relaxed, we probably want to be with the people that we love in a small room surrounding a book or a game or a TV. And whether we're rich or poor, like, those scenes were the scenes where they felt the most normal, as opposed to breakfast where you serve yourself but you order your eggs.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, that was a fun moment. Yeah, it's engaging. I think Emerald Fennell seems to be one to watch. I personally preferred the film that she made before, Promising Young Woman. I don't know if you ever got around to watching that, but
no, I haven't watched it. I know this movie and that movie were produced by Margot Robbie, right?
Right. Right, is it like Lucky Chap or something? Her and her husband's production company, and yeah, Promising Young Woman had more to say. It's a very similar plot, actually, without wanting to give too much away to anyone. But both films involve a person kind of from outside infiltrating a group, and there's maybe more to the person than it initially seems. I think Promising Young Woman tackles a more relevant subject matter head on, you know, the kind of sexual harassment and, you know, the victimization of young women and gaslighting and things like that. Carey Mulligan kind of plays like an avenging angel, and she's fantastic. Yeah, I just felt more impact from that film. It had more of a message. I feel like the ending had a lot more heft to it, but they're both very intricately worked films, well written, incredibly assured directing from someone who's, you know, relatively new to the field, as far as I'm aware. I mean, I think Emerald Fennell, I think she did maybe theater, or maybe she wrote some books. I don't think she's a complete.
Yeah, she's. I think she's an actress,
noob, but
yeah,
an actress. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would really highly recommend Promising Young Woman. I'm pretty sure it's still on Netflix. I think it has been since the days of COVID, but, that's a great movie.
Yeah, no, that's something, again, one of the many that I want to watch. And yeah, Fennell is very self-assured and she knows what she wants, just listening to her and, you know, even just what she puts on the screen here. I think she's very confident in what she wants to show. I think, you know, many people were shocked by the nudity and sex or implied sex in this movie, but these things are her reality, or, like, you know, in some of the most disgusting and vile things that happen in this film, I think she's unafraid to put that on the screen, where you don't see films like this as much as we used to. Similar to Alexander Payne, she gets the actors together and they do the read-through, and then based on the read-throughs, she would rewrite the film based on the chemistry and the dynamics,
right,
and they have input. Or there's a how would I describe it? There's a certain scene where you don't know if someone's going to get hurt or have a hand job, and that was born out of the previous scene and just seeing a dynamic, and then she runs off and rewrites it and adds that. And then also, similar to the holdovers, some of the cast members stayed and lived on location. So again, kind of fostering certain things to bring the best out of the actors. But the way she structured it, you know, heavily reminded me of The Holdovers in terms of how well the cast gelled together and felt comfortable in the freedom to perform, not so much improv, but really flesh out their characters and to then bring that to the screen.
For sure, and definitely echoes of, you know, elite schooling and the roles that we adopt in life, whether we are serving the elite or being served, you know, that was present in both of those movies. I don't think there was any snow in Saltburn, but, you know, we can't fault it for that. Maybe there was too much salt.
That's right. When she wrote the movie, she didn't have any particular actor in mind. However, Keoghan didn't have to audition for the part. I think many of the remaining cast had to, but basically he fit the role.
Quite the meteoric rise.
And this is also his first leading role.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's true. It seems like he's been, I mean, it doesn't seem like he's been around for ages, but he's definitely in the zeitgeist and has been for a couple of years. So,
and he's probably the most relatable in Masters of Air.
Right. So
if you have an opportunity to see that, yeah, you would see him in something that's somewhat normal.
Yeah. I think it's the roles he chooses. I mean, he's the kid in Dunkirk, and he just seemed like a young person in that movie. I don't think he was particularly odd in that. But, you know, Killing of a Sacred Deer, Banshees of Inisherin, Batman, like he chooses his roles. I think he leans into these kinds of roles, and he does it very well. I think on a total tangent here, but I think Brad Pitt as a younger actor actually leaned into a lot of kind of strange roles when, you know, movies like 12 Monkeys and California, and like he had a knack for playing oddballs as well, and then a couple of leading man roles later, and that's what he'd become. So I think there are plenty of actors that can do it. I think you recognize certain things about your physicality and what you can do with your face and your eyes, and a good actor is unafraid to go all the way with that stuff, and it's definitely worked for him. I believe he, unless I'm mistaken, and I saw some footage recently where I think he auditioned for the role of the Riddler in the Batman, and he didn't get it, but because of his audition tape, you know, that's why he got the sort of cameo as the Joker. The director was so impressed with his audition that he, you know, he gave him this other role. I don't know how true that is, but
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's released the footage onto YouTube. It's very Clockwork Orange. He's kind of dressed all in green with a bowler hat and a cane, and he's kind of walking through a corridor, and, you know, it's got a definite Malcolm McDowell vibe. And you know, I guess that's probably an actor that Barry Keoghan would be familiar with as well. Another person who, as a youngster, did a lot of very bold films. In fact, that just made me think of an old British public school movie called If, which is another one about the British culture clash. But we don't want to go down that road, but another one to check out.
Oh, no, I didn't see Elordi in much. This is the first thing I've seen him in. And, oh, I shouldn't say that. Prior, he was on SNL because of this movie. But him and Keoghan had an interview, and they were talking about their favorite actors, and like Elordi mentioned, like
Hasselhoff.
Seymour.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes. Yes. Dustin Hoffman. But Dustin. So that's one. Yeah, not Dustin. But that was one of his
Dustin Diamond.
Yeah, that's right. R.I.P.
He would have been great.
You know, he would have been perfect for this.
But
so I don't remember what Keoghan's favorite actor was or influence. But might have said like they might have said Brando, but anyway, I can't remember. But he was saying some of his favorite movies were like The Basketball Diaries and Cool Hand Luke. And then it reminded me of what Nolan said also, like, you know, how much he loved The Basketball Diaries. And I feel like that's
I read the book.
Back to.
Yeah, that would be a good one. I picked up a copy a few years ago, meaning to go back to it because I read the book because I got into the guy that wrote it was a kind of young, prodigious poet and punk icon in New York. I've completely forgotten his name, but he had like, you know, a couple of hit songs back in the early 80s. And I briefly got into his stuff and then read the Basketball Diaries, which is, you know, autobiographical. And yeah, that would be a good one. I think it is Marlon Brando, by the way. I think Barry Keoghan's kid is called Brando. So I think Marlon
His son was born while shooting this movie. Oh, and that's sorry. He was talking about Basketball Diaries. And I'm thinking, sorry, Nolan, he was talking about the documentary. What is the documentary called?
Oh, my goodness. The really famous basketball documentary from the 90s.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my God. It's so good. What's it called? All I can think of is that Nick Nolte movie, Blue Chips, with Shaq and Penny Hardaway in it. But what's the documentary called? It's like the most famous sports documentary. Ah, yes. Oh, it's so good. And I can't remember what it's called.
What was it called? Oh, Hoop Dreams? Is that it?
Hoop Dreams.
Hoop Dreams. Yeah.
Hoop Dreams.
So it was Hoop Dreams. That was Nolan. And then, yeah, Keoghan, I think he said Basketball Diaries and Cool Hand Luke.
Cool Hand Luke, great movie.
I don't know if
great movie.
You might not want to quote me on that.
Well, I mean, but it's a good movie. If he doesn't like it, he should. Okay, well, I think you've got five things to go and check out there. Shogun, Anatomy of a Fall, Jury Duty, The Curse, and Saltburn. Just be aware of stunt fallacies while you're trawling through those five films. Mm. You know, there's sometimes more than meets the eye.
What were they called? The Cherry Boys? Cherry Boys? What were they called?
The
Tomato
Baby Tomatoes. Baby Tomato Brothers or something. Keep your eyes peeled for that. Keep your tomatoes peeled. Okay, well, that was all very, very interesting. That was a good discussion, BC. What are you looking forward to over the next 2 weeks or fortnight? If you're from where I'm from,
possibly seeing Dune Part 2.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I'll see it within the next 2 weeks, but that's probably one of the few things I'm looking forward to. I need to go back and watch the first one. So,
yeah.
I'll definitely give that a rewatch before going to the theater. That's the only thing I can think of. Oh, and possibly Poor Things, I think, drops on Hulu this week. So I want to give that a watch, and just still plowing through Masters of Air. Those are the things that are kind of still top of my list, and The Bad Batch.
Yeah, much the same. The Bad Batch will continue. I already said that I watched Contact at the weekend. I think we're going to watch Signs this weekend, which is another semi-grounded space alien movie. Not really, but I told my eldest son about it and he wants to watch it now.
There's only like one really good scene in that movie.
I've always wanted to go back to it. I think it's my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movie, but that's not saying much because I don't really like his films.
I saw it in the theater with my friend, and I remember there's one. Well, I mean, can I spoil it since it's like a million years
old? Yeah, go for it.
But it's like there's the aliens or what have you. And then it was on the news where these kids are having a birthday party, and then the alien walks by the window and they freeze it. And I just remember my friend howling and pointing at the screen. that was such a moment, like it's in my head.
That's the latest thing. Apparently people are now going to watch Madame Web, and it's just turned into like a laugh riot. People just go to laugh at it, and they're saying it's like the best cinema experience in years because it's just so, you know, it's like what's that awful film that people intentionally just go and watch because it's terrible? You're tearing me apart. The Room. They're like, Madame Web is like the new The Room. Apparently.
Well, it's not enough money for that, though, because it's tanking. Morbius was the same. They tried to capitalize on that and didn't do much. But yeah, I think I don't know if it really, it's hard for me to say if like superhero fatigue is like a real thing or not, because you can have so many different genres, but I just think there's been such a string of terrible movies. Morbius, Madam Web, the Marvels, I didn't think was good. Like this Aquaman 2 was just like, well, I barely liked the first one. I didn't like the first one, to be quite honest, but just seeing some of this stuff on the screen, it's baffling the amount of money in years people invest in this stuff, and it's just like it's hard for me to comprehend what a waste of money and time and energy, like, and resources to make these things, and they're just so like subpar. It's insane. And like, where you're capable of making like good superhero fare, but this, like, I mean, just the recent string of these movies is just really like hurt the box office and like chances of like people making more of these things. So we'll see how it goes with, like, you know, James Gunn taking over and seeing what Ryan Reynolds can do to salvage the MCU. But it's all been been weak for the past couple of years, and on TV as well. Like, I mean, it's hard. And we'll see what they'll do with Star Wars too, trying to resuscitate that again with the new theatrical releases. But yeah, it's
tough,
pretty,
tough time to be a franchise.
I think it's a tough time for movies in general. I think people really haven't gone back, and you have streaming. Like, there's so many things I would like to watch in a theater, but if I know it's coming, depending on what it is, I'm not going to go out and see it. It has to be, you know, really worth it. You know, I'm perfectly fine watching movies at home, paying one way instead of going to the theater. I can watch, you know, a lifetime or multiple lifetimes worth of things, you know, at home. I just don't have the time. So, but that's also an investment. And I think a lot of these movies we're talking about today are, you know, blowing up because of the streamers. Because like Saltburn, I think, because once it dropped on Amazon Prime, then there was more interviews with the cast and those sorts of things happened to like promote it on a streaming service. And you're seeing it with a lot of these movies, like, I guess, Oscar fare, more or less. Like, that's, you know, except for like Oppenheimer, but it had that spectacle, you know. And then Barbie, it was something different and really, you know, hit the zeitgeist, and that made a lot of money. But we're really not seeing that many movies making that much at the box office anymore. But it sounds like Dune 2, you know, I think is going well beyond expectations, and hopefully you'll get a third movie, because this is also supposed to be really good so far based on all the feedback and reviews. So I definitely want to see that in the theater. I missed out on the first one because it was during COVID and dropped on HBO Max on the same day. But I'm not going to miss out on the second one in the theater.
Me neither. All right. Well, something to look forward to then. So as ever, if you want to check out some somewhat short TikTok reviews, I'm Dr. Welp on TikTok. I'm also Dr. Welp on Instagram. I tried to get my Twitter working today, but that's still a work in progress. Other than that, I am completely untraceable. What about you, BC? Where can we find you on the web?
You can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, Threads. At least on those platforms, I have stuff up. I'm the most active on Threads at the moment. And I have a blank TikTok and a blank YouTube channel.
Nice. There you go. Prime,
so hopefully I can
internet real estate.
Soon. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, well, thank you so much for listening. Here's another 2 hours of your life you won't get back. And we'll do our best to, you know, watch the stuff that's coming to save you a few hours here and there. And yeah, I've been Maurice Welp. Thank you so much.
And I'm BC Noir. We'll see you on the flip side.
And watch out for Corbin Burnson's cock.